Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 437 for August 12th, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
We're not trying to be the biggest distiller in the world. You know, I mean, we don't want to become one of the big boys by any stretch. We want to get to a comfortable level for us. You know, we're a family-owned company. We don't want to have hundreds of employees. We don't want to reach every, you know, the four corners of the earth.
Spent the last few days in Wyoming, catching up with David DeFazio, the Meads, and the rest of the folks at Wyoming Whiskey. It's been a little more than 9 months since the first batch was released in Kirby last December. We'll get a status update and talk with some of the guys behind the bar at Bin 21 in Jackson Hole about their experiences with the state's namesake bourbon. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and in the What I'm Tasting This Week department, my tasting notes for an old Pulteney, all on this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Lots of new bourbons to talk about this week. Heaven Hill is releasing a 21-year-old single-barrel Elijah Craig bourbon. It's the one and only time that Heaven Hill plans to do a 21-year-old Elijah Craig. Until now, the only way to get one that old was to visit Heaven Hill's Bourbon Heritage Center in Bardstown. It's being bottled at 45% ABV and will sell for around $140 a bottle. Meanwhile, Four Roses is celebrating its 125th anniversary this year and will release its annual limited edition small batch bourbon in time for the Kentucky Bourbon Festival next month. This year's edition features three of the 10 Four Roses recipes, with the whiskey coming from batches 13 to 18 years old. 8,000 bottles will be available. A few miles away, Buffalo Trace is out with the 10th batch of Single Oak Project bourbons. Each batch tests a different variable in otherwise identically produced whiskeys. This time around, they experimented with entry proof. The rye and wheat-based mash bills were filled into casks at either 125 proof, that's 62.5% ABV, or 105 proof, 52.5%. The other seven variables remained the same. And finally, Old Forester's annual birthday bourbon is on its way. It's the 12th year for the birthday bourbon, which celebrates Brown-Forman founder George Garvin Brown's birthday every September 2nd. The whiskey comes from a single day's production at the Brown-Forman Distillery in Louisville and is being bottled at 48.5% ABV. By the way, I came home from Wyoming to find samples of these bourbons waiting for me. I'll have tasting notes for them soon at WhiskeyCast.com. In other new releases, Auchentoshan is jumping on the Virgin Oak bandwagon with a single malt matured in Virgin American White Oak. Last month, its sister distillery, Glengarry, released its own Virgin Oak single malt. August means one thing for music lovers in Scotland, Runrig. The band's annual outdoor concert near Inverness was this past Saturday, and Single Malts Direct has bottled a 1995 Glen Grant cask for Runrig's 40th anniversary. Only 250 bottles are available. Our buddy Davin DeCergamo has been nominated for another award for his excellent book, Canadian Whiskey. He's on the shortlist for the annual Taste Canada Food Writing Awards. The winners will be announced on November 4th in Toronto. There's an unusual whiskey tasting coming up this weekend in Wyoming. Couldn't go out there without stopping by the Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City. The South Pass City ghost town is just up over the hill, and Bob and Barbara Townsend are part of a unique tasting coming up this Saturday.
This is called the Night Shift at South Pass City State Historic Site. The site will open the Carissa Gold Mill that night for a night shift, and they've sold 46 tickets. So there will be two groups of 23 people. Everyone will have a lantern, and they'll walk from South Pass City State Historic Site up about a half mile to the old mill. They'll go in the old mill. All of the period lighting has been reinstalled. All of the milling equipment has been reinstalled, refurbished. Their pride and joy is the ball mill, which is a 23-ton circular piece of equipment that holds 4 tons of steel balls, and you put the ore in there, the gold ore, and the ball, and you rotate the mill, and the balls inside pound the ore down into just flour, literally. So that's their pride and joy. They'll have that up and running that night. After people finish their mine tour of the mill, they'll walk back down into South Pass City with their lanterns, and they'll go to the Miners Exchange Saloon, which is an 1890s era saloon. There's an old billiard table in there from the 1890s. There's an old piano, which John Mianzinski will be playing. And Barbara and I will be serving 3 different single malt whiskeys in the old saloon.
And this is already sold out, though, right?
It is sold out, and they didn't do any advertising.
So this was all done through word of mouth. Explain the historical significance of this, because this is the first time this mine has been opened in many years, right?
Yeah, the last time the mine was operational was 1949. And when you walk through the mill looks pretty much like all the guys just put down their tool belts and their equipment and walked out the door. It still looks just like that. The significance of it really is that this is the only location in the United States where a historic gold mining ghost town and a historic mill are co-located. So you can see everything that was operational way back when, and you get to enjoy the old ghost town at the same time.
Along with the whiskeys.
Correct, absolutely. And they say the superintendent of the South Pass State Historic Site is Joe Ellis, and he said, this will be the first time in many, many decades where anything of this quality has been served in that saloon. I might say it's never been in that saloon before, but I'm prejudiced.
Is there a chance it could be again in the future?
There might be. Some folks that missed out on tickets said you need to do this monthly. That's what they told Joe. So I doubt if that'll happen.
But for the people who can't make that, the other big event that's coming up is the Atlantic City Book Fair, which I understand is probably the smallest town ever in the U.S. that has its own book fair. And Barbara, I want you to tell me about this.
Well, this came about because my novel, Blood Atonement, will be released on August 22nd. And obviously, it's a big deal, so I wanted to have a launch party for it. But I didn't want to just do it for myself. And for a tiny town such as Atlantic City, Wyoming, I wanted to incorporate the other folks that are here. And for a tiny town, there are a total of 7 of us who are either part-timers or full-timers here who are published. And I wanted to enjoy it with them and bring them in, and they're all excited about it. I'm ecstatic about it. One of the gals that's coming is Betty Carpenter Pfaff, and she is the niece of Miss Ellen Carpenter, who I consider our icon for this old hotel. And Betty just celebrated her 90th birthday, and she's coming all the way from Diamondville to be here for this event, and we are so excited to have her here.
Now, a few seconds ago, Barbara was very emphatic about the Wyoming part of Atlantic City. We've not really talked about this before, but how much confusion do you get with that other Atlantic City about 2,000 miles east of here that more people know about?
Well, Mark, there's a guy who lives in New Jersey who I spoke with yesterday morning, who I hope listens to this broadcast, because when he called yesterday morning at 7:30 our time, he told me that he lives in New Jersey and he's on his way to a concert last night that he was going to attend, and he knows the band. He wanted to buy the drummer in the band a bottle of single malt Scotch whiskey. He specifically wanted Ben Ryan's 15-year-old. And I said, well, we don't have Ben Ryan's 15-year-old. We've got a Ben Ryan's 14-year-old. And then I decided I shouldn't probably tease with him very much, and I asked him if he thought we were in New Jersey, and he said, well, absolutely. You're in Atlantic City. I said, yes, we're in Atlantic City, but we're in Wyoming. And he felt very silly, and I tried to convince him he didn't need to, because he's not the first person we've talked to along those same lines. But he and I had about a 15-minute conversation. It was very nice and cordial, and we had a lot of fun.
This has happened before, hasn't it?
Absolutely. We had a lady call from New York City who wanted to come down for the weekend. And I said, it's a long drive to come down here for the weekend. And she said, well, you're just in Atlantic City. And I said, yes, but we're in Wyoming.
If you've looked at the calendar, this past Saturday was the second Saturday of August, and I was out there for this month's second Saturday single malt tasting at the Miner's Delight Inn. Check the website for our new episode of WhiskeyCast HD from Atlantic City later this week. Time now for our weekly update on the saga of White & MacKay. Since our last episode, White & MacKay CEO Ashwin Malik stepped down to return to India with his family. He was replaced by John Beard, who left as CEO of McCarty Brown Forman's UK operations to join White & MacKay. Well, this weekend, the Herald reported that Beard has now left White & MacKay. And what's more, Chairman Vijay Mallya and Director Ayani Nedangani have also resigned from the White & MacKay board. Mallya remains chairman of White & MacKay's parent company, United Spirits. But now that Diageo has control of United Spirits, it's not clear what's going to happen at White & MacKay. We're still waiting for that report from the UK's Office of Fair Trading on its investigation into the Diageo-United Spirits tie-up and what recommendations it will make to preserve competition in the Scotch whiskey market. And that's this week's White & MacKay update. Finally, we've all seen bourbon barrels used for a lot of things over the years, but Matt Colglazier and Stuart Hobson of Heartland Distillers in Indiana have turned the distilling process around just a bit. They've turned a bourbon barrel into a still. The barrel forms the pot, while the column and condenser are made out of copper, and there are two electrical heaters inside the barrel to heat up the mash. They're calling the result log and copper whiskey. No word on how it tastes. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at WhiskeyCast.com.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Help us select the next Glenmorangie single malt whiskey with the Glenmorangie Caskmasters project. Sign up online through the Glenmorangie Facebook page or on glenmorangie.com.
This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Highland Park. It's a small world. Yeah, that's a cliche we've all heard many times before. But here's some proof of just how small the world really is. I was at the Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City, Wyoming, for the second Saturday tasting. Bob Lick drove over from Cheyenne with his wife and family members from Florida for the evening. Turns out Bob's not originally from Cheyenne, though. He grew up here in Haddonfield, New Jersey, that charming yet regrettably dry town, and lived about two blocks over from our house. And one of the kids he ran around with back in the day grew up in our house. It really is a small world. Now, one of the whiskeys I've never tried, and probably won't if I have anything to do with it, is Fireball Cinnamon Whiskey. It's a trendy drink these days, and the guys at Pinky G's Pizzeria in Jackson Hole sell a lot of it, holding their noses as they do. Cameron, one of the bartenders at Pinky G's, told me how they make Fireball drinkable. They mix it 50-50 with Jameson and call it Fire Jam. Had some fun with that on Facebook this week. Simon Seaton of Houston came up with a few more variations on that theme. For instance, he thought a 50-50 mix of Fireball and Old Forester bourbon could be called Forest Fire. Powers and Fireball could be called Firepower. Hellier's Road and Fireball, Hellfire. And Kalila and Fireball, just call it Coal Fire. One other one, Fireball and Black Bush, you can call that one Bushfire. Now, you'd probably need something, a lot of things probably, to clean your palate after any of those. Keith Raker emailed me from Ohio with this question. Clearly tasting one whiskey after another influences the experience, with flavors from one whiskey impacting flavors in the next. For example, if I taste a light Speyside whiskey immediately after a smoky Islay, I'll have a much different perception of the Speyside than if the order were reversed. What do you find is an effective means of cleaning one's palate in between tasting samples of various whiskies? Well, Keith, there are a lot of things that work for me. Sometimes I'll eat a piece of bread or cheese in between drams. If it's a lighter whiskey, even just drinking some plain tap water will usually do the trick, or some bottled water at room temperature. I wouldn't recommend a piece of garlic bread, though, but almost anything simple and bland should do the trick. If you have a question or a suggestion, you can always post it on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com or on our Facebook page. You can also email me. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. And this week's Your Voice is brought to you by Highland Park.
My name is Daryl Haldane, Global Brand Advocate for Highland Park. Go onto our website at highlandpark.co.uk and upload your photo at Inner Circle to have your face on the walls of the Highland Park Distillery.
Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you by Laphroaig. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Australian chapter has tastings on the 16th in Adelaide, Brisbane, and Canberra. The Brandy Library in New York City has a spirit school on Japanese whiskies on August 20th, along with a Macallan and Famous Grouse tasting on the 21st. Laphroaig's Simon Brooking will preside over a whiskey dinner and tasting at the Fairmont in San Jose, California, August 22nd. Whiskey Live Shanghai is coming up August 23rd and 24th, followed by Whiskey Live Taipei August 31st and September 1st. And the Little Woody Barrel-Aged Brew and Whiskey Festival is August 30th and 31st in Bend, Oregon. You'll find whiskey events all over the world on the calendar at whiskeycast.com, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla.
Whiskey Cast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Jerry McCarthy, stillhouse operator, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
There was a time then we brought in 12 barrels, and I was asked to, I was foreman in the warehousing at the time, and it was to be handled by Nolan, and then myself, and the supervisor in question, Dennis McSweeney. And we put it together, made it up. I was told to band them, strap them, get them onto the back of a lorry. They were being shipped off up to Dublin, and they were special. And I was told it was liquid gold. It was actually Redbreast.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
This week on Whiskey Cast In Depth, I wanted to follow up on the story we first brought you last December, the launch of Wyoming Whiskey at a party in the little town of Kirby, Wyoming that brought nearly 4,000 people to the town of 92. The distillery in Kirby is in its silent season now. Master distiller Steve Nally and his wife Donna are vacationing back in Kentucky with their family. But the latest batch of Steve's whiskey is selling just about as fast as it did last December. At Bin 22 in Jackson Hole, owner Gavin Fine not only sells it by the bottle in his retail store, but bartender Travis Goodman pours it by the glass from a half barrel from Wyoming whiskey that they mounted in the middle of a wall full of wines.
Well, we're not a cocktail bar, which is makes it interesting. So the fact that we sell probably, you know, at least 10 orders of Wyoming whiskey a night in a wine bar means to say that there's probably a pretty darn high demand for Wyoming whiskey in the spot.
But you've also got the retail side too, right, Dan?
We do have the retail side. Yeah, we can't keep enough in stock. We actually had to delay our large barrel of sort of filling our barrel up until this summer release because we didn't have enough whiskey to fill our barrel up. So that actually just, we were just able to fill this up with the second round of whiskey because we sold out in the first 20 minutes.
You've actually got some available for sale too, which is rare.
Yeah, like I said, I don't know what other people in the state or what's going on, but we've tried to do the slow burn of letting Wyoming whiskey. We want to keep it on the shelves because it attracts customers constantly in. So we haven't been able to, we've done a good job of holding some back and not really putting it all on the shelves. That's probably why you see us with a little bit more than other people, because we got all of ours in, but we didn't put it all on the shelves. So.
But how fast could you sell it if you had to?
We would sell it all out, but what's great is there's a tourist that come in town or locals and they still see it there. So it's really nice for our business as well for them to have a dinner here, have a little sip here, walk out the door, be able to purchase a bottle on their way out.
That's another pretty consistent thing here.
He sells it well, that's all.
That's another consistent thing that happens here too. We have not only just the retail aspect of it, but having a bar here and having the barrel, somebody can come back and be like, well, how good is that? I mean, you know, I've heard all about it, but why don't you just have a quick taste? And that's why we can't keep it on the shelf, because they come in and have a quick taste and they're like, well, that is as good as everybody says it is.
Yeah, Travis, I got to ask you, how'd you come up with the idea for those glasses? Because those are cool.
I just saw the bottle and immediately I knew I had to make a glass out of that. So I made one and then brought it in, showed it to some folks. And thank goodness he found somebody to make them, because I couldn't do that for the rest of my life. I probably made over 100 of them now and my hands hurt. But yeah, it's just saw that bottle. Saw the fact that it said Wyoming on one side, whiskey on another side. It's heavy as lead. and it just holds a lot of whiskey when you fill that up. So I mean, it's just a perfect bottle to be turned into a perfect glass.
Travis makes those glasses by cutting empty Wyoming whiskey bottles in half and sanding down the edges to smooth them out. That's not the only creative use Wyomingites have found for Wyoming whiskey bottles. Co-founder David DeFazio recently received an oil lantern made from a bottle. The craftsman attached a wall bracket to the neck and added a wick and cap. Add a little food coloring to the lamp oil, and it could look just like whiskey. It's just part of the attachment the people of Wyoming have developed to their whiskey.
We have released a second and third release, which brings us up to batch number 14. And the product continues to age, it continues to improve, and we're getting a really positive response from the people that are trying it.
And you're actually still aging product longer than the 3.5 seasons that it originally had been done, right?
We are. We're leaving it in the warehouse as long as possible. And then we actually have a batch that's going to come out at the end of the summer, which is going to be about 4.5 years old, that we're really looking forward to, which is batch 15. It's going to be a single batch release. It's not going to be a multi-batch release like the last couple. And we're really looking forward to seeing what it's going to produce.
What's the response been? I know that a lot of folks around Wyoming are having a hard time still finding it, right?
Yeah, I mean, the proof is in the pudding. And the bottom line is that whenever we release, it sells out almost immediately. You could still find a couple straggler liquor stores here and there that have a bottle or two on the shelf. But overall, the larger retailers sell out within a day. So it's been it's really been overwhelming, and the response has been overwhelming, and we hope to have plenty available this year, this upcoming December, so that the liquor stores aren't selling out, and we'll be able to satisfy the thirst of Wyoming, and come next summer, satisfy the thirst of the millions of people that roll through in order to get to Yellowstone.
And you've even had trouble keeping enough stock at your own distillery of the stuff you guys make, right?
Yeah, we are constantly hoping that a little bit is left over at the Wyoming Liquor Division in order to make sure we have enough, you know, to make it through the summer. We thought that we had apportioned enough to ourselves back in the end of June when we released batches 12, 13, and 14, but we might come up a little short because the sales have been so robust.
And that's just from people visiting the distillery, which, isolated as it is in Kirby, about 12 miles north of Thermopolis, which is just about as equally isolated, but people can find it on the map a lot easier. You're getting a lot of people coming through there, aren't you?
Yeah, summertime's our season. You know, a lot of people are moving around the Yellowstone region. Sturgis is going on this upcoming week, so we're having hundreds of bikers stop in. We had a big hog rally, which is the Harley Owners Group rally, about a month ago, which is the entire Wyoming group. We have motorhomes. We have, you know, the Griswolds rolling in their station wagon. We got everybody coming from all corners of the country and really the world. And so, yeah, we've had some hard times keeping it on our own shelves. And we're seeing almost 1,000 people a month come through the distillery.
And a lot of those people are going to start looking for it outside of Wyoming at some point here fairly soon, right?
That's correct. Coming up this fall, we're looking very closely at which markets we would like to launch into. And, you know, we have a couple top picks right now, and we're about to start interviewing distributors to see who's going to be the best fit for us.
Without giving any real specifics, can you sort of say where you might head first? Presumably the markets around Wyoming would be the most logical to start, right?
Yeah, we'd like to surround Yellowstone and make sure that anybody who's visiting the Rocky Mountain region is going to be able to grab it, because, you know, that's really how we're positioned, is that of a Rocky Mountain bourbon, a Western Mountain bourbon. And so I think you're going to see us looking really hard at Colorado. I think you're going to see us looking at some of the routes that lead people here, like folks from Texas, Chicago. You know, these are all markets that I think any company would be looking at. So we're not special in that way. But we do think that there are a couple markets that we've looked at that really fit us quite well, and I think will be well received.
When I was out here last December, Steve is talking at that point about how he could expand production if he had to. Have you made any decisions along those lines yet, or are you still at the stage where let's see what we've got before we decide to start making more of it and expanding?
Yeah, we're taking a cautiously optimistic approach to it. We do have the ability to expand by 50%, and it won't take that long to do it. I've spoken to Rob Sherman back at Vendome, and they could get us the equipment we need in pretty short order. But we really want to see what the response is going to be this December before we start making plans like that. I think that's a little presumptuous for us to be doing that right now. despite the fact that it's been so well received within the state.
Even though the longer you wait, the longer you're going to have to wait down the road for it to mature to take advantage of that extra production, right?
Yeah, but we're not trying to be the biggest distiller in the world. You know, I mean, we don't want to become one of the big boys by any stretch. We want to get to a comfortable level for us. You know, we're a family-owned company. We don't want to have hundreds of employees. We don't want to reach every, you know, the four corners of the earth. We would like to satisfy a couple key markets that are really, that are deserving of it, you know, that are real bourbon-drinking towns. And hopefully put ourselves on the map in that style as opposed to just trying to dominate the country.
Has this been everything you thought it would be?
I never knew what this would be. I mean, as we talked before, you know, I'm an attorney by trade, and I'm a whiskey drinker. I've enjoyed it for years, but the thought of doing this, like I said before, had never crossed my mind until Brad and Kate approached me with it. So I didn't know what to expect. I think it's been more than I might have thought at times, and it's been different at times, but overall it's been a learning experience that I couldn't have gotten any other way than just jumping in, you know, with both feet and going for it.
What do you think the future holds? You know, you said you don't want to be the biggest distillery in the world, but realistically, what can you see Wyoming whiskey becoming 10, 15 years down the line?
I would hope that people would look at us as America's next great bourbon, not mass produced, but available if you are looking for it, and settle into a comfortable production level where we're releasing enough to the markets that we've selected and we're servicing those markets without there being any false shortages or actual shortages. And then in addition to that, I mean, it's a great question. We'd like to hold back enough so that we have line extension, not extensions, but an 8-year-old bourbon. Maybe we'll do a double barrel that Steve selects. Maybe we'll do a 15-year-old. You know, we really need to find the sweet spot of our whiskey and make sure that we have enough product to service that type of a product. And then experiment with some other things. You know, we do, it's no secret that we've got a few hundred barrels of rye in our warehouse. And we've got some rye bourbon that we've made. And we're going to continue to do those types of things. But I don't think anybody should expect to see us coming out with a cherry bourbon or anything like that. If anything, we might try a completely different type of alcohol, but only if we could source the ingredients here in Wyoming.
Which is the other key thing we've talked about before, is the fact that you were able to get all the grains within 100 miles, essentially, of the distillery and in the state of Wyoming. The only thing you couldn't do was get the barley malted, right?
Correct. We had to go to Great Falls in order to get that done, but it's always sequestered apart from all of the other grains that they are malting, so we know that what's going into our product is 100% Wyoming or Wyoming-grown grains.
How do the farmers feel having a local market for their crop now?
They're great. Brent Raggeth is our guy that grows most of our corn, or all of our corn, and did our rye a few years ago, and he is a guy who is so passionate about being involved with us. He drove all the way from the other side of Wyoming to meet with us in Jackson in order to discuss the exact strain of corn he selected for us because of the starch yields that Steve had selected. And when the rye came about, he said, this is the type of rye, and he grew some wheat for us. And he's very thoughtful about it. He's very knowledgeable. And boy, the guy just, he promotes, we don't pay him a penny other than for the grain, and he promotes us everywhere. So they're excited.
How's the relationship with the state? Because we talked back in December about the fact that everything sold out in that first batch literally within minutes, and the state liquor board really wasn't in a position to handle that much demand that quickly. Have they gotten things figured out now to where they can at least ration some of this out and keep the retailers and keep the bars happy and try to at least make the best of the situation until you have more stock?
They have, and there's no perfect solution. And we recognize that, they recognize that. But after the first go-round, when a lot of the, hundreds of retailers couldn't get any of it, they went to a maximum case order. And so each retailer was limited to 4 cases during our second release and 10 cases at the end of June. And that all sold out. And I think that that whole problem is going to dissolve come this December when we have enough volume to satisfy the entire state. And I'll tell you, it's going to be weird walking into a liquor store and actually seeing our product on the shelf because it's only there for hours now. I'm going to think that we're failing or something if there actually is stock on the shelf. But Obviously, that's ridiculous, a ridiculous way to look at it, but it is going to be weird. But yeah, the answer to your question, yeah, they have solved it, and it's going to evaporate here come December.
They're also getting involved with one of Wyoming's other passions, rodeo. Wyoming Whiskey helped support this year's Cheyenne Frontier Days Rodeo and will be at the National Finals Rodeo in Las Vegas later this fall. That's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with one of the whiskeys I mentioned last week. Jailer's Tennessee Whiskey is one of the Capital Brands whiskeys with an uncertain future after the company ceased operations earlier this month. There are talks underway that could get things back on track, though, and the whiskey itself wasn't the problem. Jailer's comes from an undisclosed Tennessee distillery, either Jack Daniel's or George Dickel, but all parties have agreed to a gag order on naming the actual source. It's bottled at 43% ABV. The nose is warm and spicy with black pepper, hazelnut, dark chocolate, almond, and honey notes. The taste is peppery, with honey and brown sugar on top of the spice, along with hints of almond and dark chocolate. The finish is long and spicy with black pepper fading away slowly and touches of caramel and dark chocolate. I'm scoring Jailer's Tennessee Whiskey an 84, and here's hoping the company gets things turned around soon. Corsair makes whiskeys in both Nashville, Tennessee, and Bowling Green, Kentucky, and recently came out with Rhymageddon. I don't have a sample of that one yet, but I did have Corsair's 100% rye whiskey, and it's a close cousin. It's bottled at 46% ABV. The nose is smooth, rich, and warm with soft rye balanced well with honey, caramel, and a touch of oak. The taste has spices that build nicely to an intense pepperiness that fades to reveal honey, caramel, and a hint of milk chocolate. The finish is short and sweet with just the barest hint of spice. I'm scoring Corsair's 100% rye an 85. And finally, I've had a sample of the Old Pulteney 40-year-old on the table for a while. It's bottled at 51.3% ABV, and the nose is very soft and smooth with caramel, vanilla, and hints of nutmeg. The taste, though, is very vibrant with pepper balanced by caramel, vanilla, and nutmeg for a good consistency, and those flavors linger very nicely through the long finish. It doesn't have to be complex to be good. It just has to be good, and this one is. I'm scoring the Old Pulteney 40-year-old a 92. I'm adding these notes to our searchable list of more than 1,000 different whiskeys at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the calendar of events, news updates, and much more, including a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast, proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you each week from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.